So now we can finally talk about slide one after listing the functions. This is an overview of the anatomy. And some of these you're very familiar with already. Some things you might not know the names of. But if we think about it in terms of the flow of air into the lungs, I guess we should start with the mouth and nose, both of which are the beginning of the airway. We have, by the way, what is called tidal breathing. Tidal meaning in and out versus just one way through. On the other hand, a fish does not have tidal breathing. A fish exchanges gases with its respiratory medium, which in that case is liquid instead of air. And so that water just makes a one-way movement past the gills, in and out a different place, instead of in and then back out. Fish wouldn't be able to do that because it would be really expensive energetically to take this fluid that's about 1,000 times more dense than air and therefore heavy, move it, stop it, and then move it in the other direction. Air, though, it's pretty easy to move in one direction, stop, and then move in the other direction, which is what tidal breathers do. Now, we could, it would be more efficient if we didn't even have to do that, if we could also just be moving the air past an external set of gills like fish do, so that we wouldn't even have to put any energy into breathing. Just being out in the open air would continuously allow exchange of gas. What's the problem with that, though? In other words, why don't we have gills like a fish? A gill and a lung are really the same thing. A gill is an evagination, so it's an outpocketing of the body, whereas a lung is an invagination. It's an in-pocketing, tucked inside the body. Why do we use lungs instead of gills? Or what would be the problem for gills with us? Well, it would work the same way as a lung. Right, it would dry out. We're terrestrial organisms. And so a gill would work well, but it would be a huge surface that would be continuously evaporating. So the terrestrial environment is a desiccating environment. We have to keep our respiratory epithelium moist. A fish doesn't have to worry about that. It lives in moisture. So, it hangs it out the side, whereas we can't do that. We have to put it into a body cavity, basically, which is really outside of our body, right? Just like the alimentary canal is outside of our body, but it's tucked in so that it can stay moist. Anyway, the airway through the nose and through the mouth come together at the back, but you already know that you can either breathe through your nose or through your mouth. They're both inputs into this tidal way of breathing. So if we look at the nasal cavity, I'll talk about that in the next slide where we have more detail. The mouth and the nasal cavity come together, though, at the back of the throat, which is really the top of the throat. And what's the proper anatomical term for the throat? The pharynx. Yes, the pharynx. The pharynx is what I've compared to a hallway before. Right, a hallway with different doorways on it. So it's a common passageway for air, food, and drink. Now they can come in at the same place. Basically, you can inhale air through the mouth. You can also drink through the mouth. You can eat through the mouth. But they need to go different places depending on what they are, right? So the food and drink, ideally, you want those to go to the esophagus, which is one of the outlets at the other end of the pharynx. Whereas the air, you want to go to the lungs, Well, to do that, they have to go through the trachea, which is another exit at the other end of the pharynx. So once we actually are at the trachea, then from there onward, which is inferior, it's all about air, not food or drink. At the very top of the trachea, though, as you see here, is where the larynx is, which is, don't confuse that with pharynx. The larynx is the vocal organ, or houses the vocal organ. The larynx is what's called the voice box. But the larynx is really the very first part of this airway, this passageway that is for air only, not food or drink. Okay? And so this space right there, that's where food and drink will go one way through the esophagus, air will go through the larynx and then into the trachea in the other direction. All right, the trachea is a single tube, but at its end, it bifurcates, splits into two. And so those two tubes are called bronchi, which is the plural of bronchus. There's two because there's one for each lung. And then as we'll look at later, the bronchi branch themselves into smaller bronchi and then smaller and smaller tubes. We'll get into that later. Notice that the epiglottis is a little flap. And this is important in sending food and drink only to the rear or posterior of the two passageways that lead out of the pharynx. That's what the esophagus is. Okay, that's the posterior of the two tubes. The trachea lies anterior to the esophagus. And so when you swallow, the food or drink, whatever you're swallowing, pushes, there's also some muscles that help this out, but the food itself pushes this epiglottis, which is a pliable kind of lid-like structure, so that it covers the opening to the trachea, or the larynx first and then the trachea. In other words, it covers the airway so that food or drink doesn't get in the airway. And instead it slides off of the epiglottis and goes into the esophagus. Now notice that the esophagus is really narrow in this diagram. And that's because the esophagus is only necessary while you're swallowing. Right? And therefore it can be a completely closed tube the rest of the time. Not so for the trachea. Your trachea you need to have open all the time. So the esophagus is a soft-walled, collapsible tube, kind of like those pool hoses I've already used in other examples. They're only open when they're forced open, which is when something is being swallowed. Anyone remember what the proper term for swallowing is? Gustation is tasting, but swallowing is deglutition. We'll see whether you remember that in the digestive system chapter. Anyway, the airway needs to always be open, so it's not a collapsible tube, the trachea. Instead, it has rings of cartilage that are very much like the spiral wire in dryer hose that keeps it open rather than having it collapse. Okay, now the lungs themselves, of course, there are two. They are not symmetrical, though. So we have bilateral symmetry as humans, but that's really only superficially, right? For instance, we don't have a liver on each side. We have it on one side and not the other. Same with the spleen and so on. Well, the asymmetry in the lungs would otherwise be pretty much symmetrical if it weren't for the fact that the heart is slightly off-center, like what we've already talked about. So in most people, the heart is slightly off-center to the left. And I say most people because one out of every however many people, I don't know, 10,000 or something, whatever it is, maybe 1,000, have situs inversus, which means everything is switched right to left. So they'll have a liver on the right, on the left side, and a spleen on the right side, and their heart will be slightly off-center to the right. In any case, though, most people are as drawn here, and the heart is a little bit off-center to the left, which means that takes up some of the volume that the left lung would otherwise occupy, which is why the left lung in most people is slightly smaller in volume than the right lung, and therefore it's made up of only two lobes, the left lung is, whereas the right lung has three lobes and is the bigger lung. All right? Now, we don't see the place where, because the aorta is in the way here, we don't see where, in this figure, where the trachea bifurcates into the two bronchi. But those two immediate bronchi are called primary bronchi, which can also be called main bronchi. Primary and main here mean the same thing. So there's a left main bronchus and a right main bronchus. But then when they branch into what are called lobar bronchi, which is another name for secondary bronchi. Okay, you can use primary, secondary, and tertiary just for numerical reasons, but they also have other names. Main makes sense for primary. Lobar makes sense for secondary because they correspond to the lobes of the lung. All right? Which means on the left side, the left main bronchus is going to branch into two lobar bronchi or secondary bronchi, whereas the right primary bronchus, which is going to the right lung, is going to split into three lobar bronchi, because there are three lobes in the right lung. And then those lobar bronchi, or secondary bronchi, each split themselves into even smaller ones, which can either be called tertiary bronchi, because it's the third level of splitting, or as you see here, segmental bronchi. And the reason segmental makes sense is because each lobe of a lung is itself subdivided internally into what are called segments. So each segment gets served by its own segmental bronchus or tertiary bronchus. Now, the pleura that's listed on the left side is an example of what? The pleura is a covering of the lungs, but it's a covering made up of two membranes, and therefore the pleura overall is an example of what? A serous membrane, right. So we've talked about a serous membrane in the circulatory system. What was that called? The pericardium. The serous membrane in the respiratory system is the pleura. So there's a pleura around each lung. Now, what is it that makes any given serous membrane a serous membrane? What does the word serous mean? Yeah, it's just the adjective form of serum, but what does serum mean?
Fluid.
What kind of fluid, though?
Watery.
Watery, right. This is why serum is more watery than plasma, which is also a liquid, right? Because you've removed some of the protein. The fibrinogen gets removed, so it's more watery than plasma. Serum means watery fluid. Blood serum is just one type of serum, in other words. So serous membranes in general get their name because between those two layers of membrane that they all feature is a watery fluid called serous fluid. In the case of the pericardium around the heart, that fluid was called pericardial fluid. Here we have fluid between the two layers of the pleura, and we call that fluid the pleural fluid. All right? But what is the job of serous membranes in general? Why do we have them? Lubrication, so that the things that are being surrounded by the serous membrane can move with respect to the surrounding organs without rubbing on each other, like I said with the balloon analogy. So, I mean, that's really important for the lungs because they undergo such a big change in volume each breath, they would just rub the hell out of each other and surrounding tissues. Okay. Let's go to slide two and look at the nasal cartilages. The nose features two holes. You probably knew that already. Most people call those nostrils, but they can also be called nares, not nares. Looks like it's pronounced nares, and I hear people say that all the time, but it's nares. And the reason it's nares is because it's a plural. The ES ending is plural for what singular ending? No, I mean in general, what ending? IS, right, like penis, penis is the plural. Crisis, crises. Testis, testes. Well, one individual nostril is called a nares, and therefore two of them are called nares. Anyway, back to the cartilages. The part of the nose that's visible to us, is what's really what we mean usually when we say nose, is just the external part that we see. Part of that is hard, part of it is medium hard, and part of it is soft. The hard part is actually bone. So there are two nasal bones, which you should remember from 201. But those are just at the base of the nose, or the bridge of the nose. The bulk of what we cosmetically call the nose is given its shape and its structure from cartilages. And so notice that there are lateral cartilages, so named because they're on either side. Lateral means to the side. There are septal nasal cartilage. There is septal nasal cartilage because it is part of the nasal septum. Now, the nasal septum, like any septum, is a septum for what reason? Why does it get the name septum? Because it separates two halves, right? So just like we talked about the septum in the heart, right? There's a nasal septum that is partially bone, you don't see it in here, and partially cartilage. The cartilaginous component of the nasal septum is the anterior part, which is why it comes to be visible in this figure. Then there are alar cartilages as well, a pair of minor and a pair of major alar cartilages. Alar, A-L-A-R, is the adjective of ala, A-L-A. What does ala mean? Anyone know? It means wing. So these are wing-like in shape, according to the person who named them. That's not as hard as bone, but still pretty tough stuff. The most pliable part of the nose, if you play around with yours, are the very side parts, which aren't cartilage, they're just dense connective tissue. Cartilage itself, of course, is connective tissue. But dense connective tissue isn't nearly as hard as cartilage. It has collagen in it, and so it keeps its shape well, but can easily be deformed. All right, let's go on to three. You have a median view of a cadaver on the top, but the cartoon version is easier to look at and make sense of. Here we can have a better view of the nasal cavity. It's actually the same view we saw before, but now we have some labels to apply. And notice that the nasal cavity is not just a smooth, open surface. There are several different folds in the nasal cavity. And so we're looking at just one half of it. There's symmetry on the other half that would be, you know, if you were looking at it from the other direction, there would be these three major folds on the other side as well. So there's six major folds. And the reason that these folds have their shape is because of bony structure. We're not looking at the bone here. The bones, which are the hard parts, of course, are called bones or bony structures, I should say, are called, depends on kind of animal. In us, they're called nasal conchae, C-O-H-C-H-A-E, which is the plural of concha. And any idea what concha means? shell, like a conch shell, right? In other animals, they're often called nasal turbinates. But anyway, that it's boniness that gives them their shape. We're looking here, well, the bone is then covered with connective tissue, which is softer, of course. And then that connective tissue is wrapped superficially by epithelium. So the pink that we're looking at here is the epithelium that overlies these harder structures. And that's the nasal epithelium. Why do we have these nasal conchae? Why not just have a smooth surface inside? Well, if we did have a smooth surface inside the nasal cavity, then the air coming in and leaving would flow pretty easily. It would have laminar flow, like the flow through an unobstructed blood vessel. Remember I talked about laminar flow? Well, as opposed to laminar flow, you can also have turbulent flow, which is kind of chaotic flow. It's not nice, smooth streams. The nasal conchae, by being projections into the nasal cavity, actually create turbulence in the flow of air, entering and exiting. It causes swirling, in other words, of this air, rather than just straight shot into the structures after the nasal cavity. What this ensures is that there's going to be a lot more contact between the air and the nasal epithelium. Because if it were laminar, yes, some air would be in contact with the epithelium, but some of it would, just like the blood that's right in the middle of the vessel, would never touch the vessel itself, right? Here, some of that air would never touch the nasal epithelium. The reason this is important is for reasons of water savings. When you breathe air in, usually it's cooler outside than it is here, than it is in your body. So when you breathe air in, you're usually heating the air, and warmer air can hold more water vapor than cooler air, which is why it gets dewy when the temperature drops. That cold air can no longer hold that amount of water, so it condenses out. Anyway, you heat the air because your body's warmer than the air. But you also humidify that air because it's coming into contact with a moist epithelium, the nasal cavity. You do that because you don't want to really send dry air to the lungs, which are also moist and have to stay moist. You don't want to dry the lungs out, basically, so you want to send air that's saturated with water vapor, 100% relative humidity, in other words, to the lungs to keep them moist. Okay? Well, moistening that air as you inhale it takes water from the body, because that water comes from the nasal cavity, right? When you evaporate water from a surface, what happens to that surface? It cools. Evaporation cools the surface. Just with the same reason that you sweat, right? That's what keeps you alive in the summer. So you hydrate the air, you humidify the air as you breathe it in, but you also cool your nasal epithelium each inhalation. Now, the other half of tidal breathing is exhalation. And so if you were to just breathe out your mouth, which you can do, you're going to get rid of a lot of water vapor from that moist air coming from the lungs. All right? It would be nice if you could reclaim that water so that you don't lose so much by breathing. You have to breathe, but if you breathe through your mouth, because of the nasal conchae, you can reclaim a lot of that water that you spent on humidifying that air by reversing the process of evaporation. What's the reverse process? condensation. So remember that the nasal epithelium was cooled in the previous inhalation because of the evaporation. Now when that warm air encounters encounters the cool nasal epithelium, it's going to be cooled. The air itself will be re-cooled, which will bring it down below its dew point. And therefore, it can't hold that water anymore. And just like leaves in the morning get dewy, the nasal epithelium is going to collect that water that condenses out of the air you're breathing. So it returns it to the body rather than to the air, which would be cause you to desiccate, cause you to dehydrate. But, you know, in an animal that does pant, what they're doing is forcing it through their mouth so that they lose as much as possible. They're doing that because otherwise they're going to overheat and die. Yeah, they don't want to lose the water, but they have to in order to cool themselves. Anyway, there are three pairs of nasal conchae, which are called superior, middle, and inferior on each side. Self-explanatory why they're named that. But although they're all made out of bone, only the two inferior nasal conchae are their own bones. So when you studied the bones of the skull, inferior nasal conchae were bones on that list. The middle and the superior nasal conchae are not their own bones. They are just features of the ethmoid bone. Remember, there is one ethmoid bone that is right in the middle, and it looks kind of like a walnut. Well, two of those folds on each side that make it look like a walnut are the superior and middle nasal conchae. Now, another thing we see here is on the bottom right in part C here, the pharynx color-coded so that you can see that it is subdivided into three parts of the pharynx, three regions. And those are called nasopharynx, oropharynx, and laryngopharynx, as you see here. And those are pretty self-descriptive as well. The nasopharynx is the superior-most part of the pharynx, and it gets its name from the fact that it directly connects to the nasal cavity. Right? Oropharynx, from oral meaning mouth, connects to the mouth. So it is right next in line in terms of flow of air. Of course, the pharynx conducts more than air, like I said. But the bottom part, the inferior part, is the laryngopharynx because of its proximity to the larynx. I'll show you the detail of the larynx itself in a different slide. You don't really see it too well right here. Is there anything else I wanted to mention while we were here, though? Oh, yeah. I mentioned earlier that the nasal septum is partly bone and partly cartilage. Well, in the median view right here, in green, you can see the vomer, which is also a bone of its own, right? It's a skull bone. Do you remember what I said vomer means? Plow. It means plow, because it looks like an old-fashioned pointed plow that would drag through the soil. So this is the bony part of the nasal septum, and then the anterior part of that, where the bone ends, there are cartilages that make up, there is a cartilage, the septal cartilage that we mentioned earlier, that makes up the cartilaginous point. Now, the vomer is just one part of the bony component. In orange here, or orangish, right above the vomer, is the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid. So the ethmoid bone, right on its midline, has a perpendicular plate, which is not a bone by itself. It's just a feature of the ethmoid. And not shown here are the other parts of the ethmoid bone, the superior and middle nasal conchae that hang off to the sides. Here you're looking right at the median plane. So all you're seeing is the perpendicular plate. Anyway, that's bone, and so is vomer. In front of that is the septal cartilage. But even though it's partly bone and partly septum, it does the job of fully separating the two halves of the nasal cavity. Now to four. So we're seeing the larynx here and the top part of the trachea. And really the main point of this slide is not so much the trachea as it is the larynx and specifically the cartilages of the larynx, which could also be called the laryngeal cartilages. Laryngeal is just the adjective of larynx. In fact, the plural of larynx is larynges, not larynxes. And plural of pharynx is pharynges. Anyway, there are nine different cartilages associated with the larynx. Three of those are much bigger than the others. And, in addition to being larger, they're all singular. So they're not paired, in other words. There's one of each of those. The other six occur as three pairs. So there's a right and a left version of each of those. Let's talk about the singular ones. Notice A is an anterior view, so you're looking at it from the front. And the biggest one, right in the front, this largest of them all, is the thyroid cartilage. And remember I told you back in the endocrine system chapter that the thyroid gland and the thyroid cartilage have that name, both have that name, meaning the same thing, which is shield-like. Well, this thyroid cartilage looks like a shield to whoever named it. That's what it means, anyway. And on the very front of the thyroid cartilage is the laryngeal prominence, just a bump on the front, which because of testosterone is develops as a bigger bump in males than in females. So this is what we have nicknamed the Adam's apple. I mean, you don't see the cartilage itself, but you see its prominence through the skin. It's a landmark. And most males have a bigger one than females, depending on the hormones. Another unpaired one, though, is the cricoid cartilage, which means ring-like. And that's because, notice on the rear view, that the cricoid cartilage makes a complete ring around the end, whereas the thyroid cartilage is mostly in front. It doesn't wrap all the way around. The other unpaired one, which lies right on the midline, as you would expect for one that is unpaired, is the epiglottic cartilage. This is the back view. This is the front view. So the epiglottis is more than just the epiglottic cartilage. The epiglottic cartilage is just the cartilage part of the epiglottis. But there's also epithelium and other connective tissue involved. The whole thing, though, is not really on a hinge, but it is moves kind of hinge-like, which is why it's able to be forced into a position that will help to close the trachea when during deglutition so that water and food don't get in there. Now, that's just part of the seal that's made. It's not a perfect seal, and if that's all you had were the epiglottis, you would still get food and drink in your trachea pretty easily. The better seal is made by the fact that you have vestibular folds in the larynx, which I'll talk more about in a minute. But now let's continue this talk about the laryngeal cartilages. So those are the three unpaired ones. You also have three pairs, though, including the arytenoid cartilages, left and right. Arytenoid means pitcher-shaped or funnel-shaped. It could mean either one. Notice that on the tips of those are two smaller paired cartilages called corniculate cartilages. Now, what does corn mean? Means horn. It does. It means horn. Something that's horny or corny are the same thing, really, in terms of anatomy. They're hardened, but here it's referring to the shape. So cornicule would mean literally little horn. Corniculate, therefore, means like a little horn. And they're separate cartilages from the arytenoid cartilages because in between them is not cartilage. In between them is ligament. You have various kinds of ligaments that are listed here. Those are not actually cartilage. That's dense connective tissue that is joining cartilage to cartilage. So in the back view is the only place that you see the corniculate and the arytenoid cartilages. The cuneiform cartilages, which are the shown right here as this ridge, it's covered actually by softer tissue. Cuneiform means wedge-shaped. Cuneiform writing that you probably learned about in grade school was produced by using a wedge-like stylus that make impressions into clay with it. So that's why it was called cuneiform writing. Cuneiform, though, means wedge-shaped. I haven't mentioned anything about the hyoid bone yet here, but it's important. You remember the claim to fame to the hyoid bone? Right, it's the only bone in the skeleton that does not articulate with another bone. So it is just a hard structure that's put in place for other things to connect to. And the hyoid bone really is right at the top of this larynx. It's deep, it's in the space formed by the U-shaped mandible, but deep in there, right at the top of the voice box. And then basically hanging from that hyoid bone is all of this stuff that we just talked about via thyrohyoid ligaments. Thyrohyoid, of course, named for the fact that the ligament is attached at one end to the hyoid and to the other end to the thyroid cartilage of the larynx. And then the trachea itself hangs via ligaments, cricotracheal ligaments, from the larynx itself. Now, while we're here, we get a good view of the trachea, just the top of the trachea, but it's the same way all the way down until it bifurcates. Notice that there are, it's not a completely hard tunnel. It's hard because it features a bunch of cartilages, but what I'm saying is it's not just one tube-like cartilage. Instead, it's many segments of cartilage with softer spaces in between as you go down. Importantly, though, these are not O-shaped cartilages. They don't form complete rings. This is the anterior view, but in the posterior view, you can see that they are C-shaped rings, not O-shaped rings. Like a bracelet versus a bangle, I guess, right? Although, which is which? Are the bangles the one that are complete? Or is that a bracelet?
That's bracelet.
Okay. The bangle's the one you can put on this way. Okay, that's what the tracheal cartilages are like. They're C-shaped. And that's really important because if they were O-shaped, yes, they would do the job of keeping the airway open all the time, but it wouldn't be possible then to change the diameter of that airway. Whereas C-shaped cartilages with this softer sheet of ligament taking up the space between the gaps of the C's, this allows for an adjustment to the diameter of the trachea, which can be done for purposes of either breathing harder or not as hard, but also importantly when you cough. When you cough, the airway constricts a little bit. A narrower pathway means that the pressure is going to be higher, and therefore you're going to speed up flow of air through that during the cough to hopefully expel whatever's in there. Similar to putting your thumb over a garden hose, right? It's going to speed up the water and cause it to shoot out farther. Okay, let's quit there. Yeah, let's